Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The House on Stillcroft Street by Joseph Payne Brennan. Emily is one of those out-of-the-way villages which the average traveler never hears about. Years ago, Main Road passed perilously close to it, but this route has since been superseded by a high-speed four-lane parkway. The old route is often nearly deserted, and almost nobody turns off at the tilted sign bearing the weathered letters Amley. I was introduced to Amley years ago by my friend Hugh Corvington, a wealthy member of my club who had stormed Wall Street successfully and retired early. Although I was a largely unrecognized rider who would have had difficulty in scraping up a penny for every $100 possessed by Corvington, for some reason he liked me and sought out my company. Occasionally, we had long, leisurely dinners together. Now and then we spent an evening over the chessboard and a bottle of good port. One June, when I was fretting about where to go for a vacation, Corvington mentioned Amley. He was casual, even diffident about it. Not much of a place, dull, you know, and not right if you want travel. Only 40-odd miles from here, but quiet and peaceful. Pleasant place, really. No trouble getting lodgings. In fact, you could bunk in with me while you looked around. I've got a small house up there. A bit cramped, I'm afraid, but there's the usual guest room. We could manage while you poked about and made up your mind. 2 weeks later, I drove up the old route, turned at the tilted sign reading Amley, and after a few miles found myself in a charming, somnolent New England village which had somehow escaped the annual invasion of the acquisitive summer people. Corvington's cramped small house turned out to be a compact Georgian gem, complete with Doric entrance columns. Less than an hour later, after a shower and a change of clothes, I was sitting with my affable host on a screened rear porch which overlooked an English-typed walled garden. As I settled back in my chair and sipped my whiskey and soda, I lost all desire to travel, to seek out lodgings, and to carry through the writing chores which I had assigned myself. Corvington seemed to sense my mood. Thought occurs to me, you know. If you can put up with this place, no real reason to muck about after room somewhere else. Stay here. I have a woman come in to fix breakfast and lunch. Dinner usually at the Black Lion Inn, Amley's only hostelry. Quite good, really. I thanked him sincerely, but insisted that I wouldn't dream of imposing on him to such an extent. He would have none of it. No imposition at all. Quite the opposite. You'd be doing me a favor. Now that I have nothing pressing me, I get bored on occasion. We might have some splendid games of chess without having to watch the clock. He refreshed my drink. Of course, you'd be free to write whenever you wanted. No intrusions there. I respect your craft. So it was settled. I understood that he would be offended if I even suggested remuneration of my accommodations. I decided that I would try to pay for most of our dinners at the Black Lion Inn and let it go at that. The summer settled in smoothly. I usually wrote for a few hours in the morning and after lunch strolled around the village. Often I walked right through into the surrounding countryside. I would return in time for a shower, cocktails, and a relaxed chat before I walked with my host to the Black Lion Inn. Not infrequently, I spent most of the afternoon sauntering about Amley's leafy streets. The peace and quiet of the place, the relatively unpolluted air, and the sense of stability surrounding the quaint old houses acted as a tonic and, I might as well admit it, a soporific. My writing proceeded more or less on schedule. Some color came back to my pale face, and I beat Corvington at chess more often than formerly. Fortunately, he was a good loser. My improving game acted as a challenge, and I think we both played better than we ever had before. I can recall many long-drawn, remorseless battles. One sun-drenched afternoon while I was strolling Amley's shaded walks, I noticed a sign reading Stillcroft Street. The name intrigued me. Quite naturally, I decided to turn at the sign. The street was little different from others in Amley. Quiet old houses, gardens, immense trees, and scarcely a soul in sight. As I neared the end of it, I saw that it was a dead-end thoroughfare, and that I would have to go back the way I had come. Sauntering to the extreme far end, I crossed the road, intending to return on the other side. It was then that I first noticed the opposite house, the last one on the street. The house itself was ordinary enough, a two-story brick square with very few embellishments, but it was surrounded by a thick growth of exotic-looking trees, shrubs, and plants, which appeared to have run wild over the premises. There was no evidence of any recent pruning, trimming, or shaping. I was particularly struck by a glossy, luxurious growth of heavy climbing ivy, which virtually covered the entire front of the house, including the windows. Only the door itself seemed to have escaped the clutch of this remarkable plant. I suppose the ivy was the common climbing variety, but I had never seen ivy leaves so large. The rich, deep green color, shining in bars of sunlight, which slanted through the trees, appeared to possess a purplish sheen. As I remained staring at the unusual growth, I caught a glimpse of a white-haired man's face peering out of one of the upper windows. The window itself was almost entirely screened by ivy leaves, and as I looked up, the face abruptly disappeared. Turning away, I continued back up Stillcroft Street toward the center of Amley. Over cocktails that afternoon, I mentioned the house to Corvington. He nodded. "That's Millward Frander's house. Noted botanist, you know. Used to travel all over the world and bring back rare plants. Had a showplace garden, but he's been ill for some years. Recluse now. Scarcely anybody sees him. Stays shut in there and the gardens run riot. Too bad." He sipped his martini, for some minutes was silent. Finally added, as an afterthought of little importance, "Second cousin of mine, actually. I've a key to the house even. Never dream of using it, of course. I like privacy, and I respect it." "You're right," I agreed. "But don't you think he's got carried away a bit? The place is going to disappear in that jungle." Corvington shrugged. "I have a sort of philosophy. Every man has a right to his own kind of madness, providing, of course, it doesn't impinge on the rights of others. If Millward wants to live in a miniature jungle, well, so be it." I dropped the subject and did not bring it up again. But every day or two I found myself sauntering down Stillcroft Street. I presume poor old Millward Frander was cursing me out as an infernal spy and busybody, but that strange, ivy-shrouded house drew me like a magnet. During the hot, brilliant summer, the ivy seemed to grow almost visibly. Ivy, of course, is not a sun lover, but the house itself was well shaded by a row of huge old elms which grew along the front walk. The ivy received very little direct sunlight. Almost as I watched it seem, the broad, five-lobed leaves, glimmering purple-green, extended their domain. Only once or twice more after my first glimpse of that white-haired old man's face at the window did I see it again. The ivy leaves sent their fluttering legions over the glass, and the window just disappeared completely. I marveled at the thing's growth, and marveled more at the occupant who willingly, I presumed, permitted his house to be swallowed up, as it were. As the summer wore on, Corvington became a bit edgy. I could see that something was beginning to bother him. I caught him frowning on occasion, and I noticed that his chess game fell off considerably. Finally, one afternoon, as we sipped our iced martinis on the screen porch, he brought up the matter. "Fernal nuisance, you know," he began. "But I'm getting a little worried about Millward. Tradesmen haven't heard from him in weeks. Mail piled up." He turned toward me. "Have you walked down Stillcroft lately?" I was perfectly aware that he knew I had. Every few days, the windows were completely covered with that climbing ivy, and I haven't seen a sign of life. I set down my drink. Of course, nobody could see a sign of life. You can have a banquet or a ball in there with nobody the wiser. The windows are simply blanked out by that greedy growth. "Odd you'd use that word." "What word?" I asked. "Greedy." He was silent for some time. At length, he reached over and refilled my glass. I suppose he said that I ought to do something. "I think so," I agreed. "I know the idea of intrusion is distasteful to you, but it would do no harm to look in on the old boy." He settled back with a sigh. "Well, tomorrow is time enough. We'll go down, and if there's no answer to the door, I'll use my key, much as I hate meddling." The next day, like most of its predecessors, was hot and sunny. After a light lunch, we started out for Millward Frander's house on Stillcroft Street. Overnight, it appeared to me, the shining purple-green ivy leaves had grown larger and more luxurious. They were everywhere. They had climbed over the eaves and started down the roof. Their tiny claspers clung to the drains, the bricks themselves, the window panes. The house looked as if it had been draped in a thick cloak of shimmering ivy. Corvington rang the bell in vain. After a 10-minute wait, he sighed with resignation and took out his key. "I hate doing this, you know." The door opened grudgingly. We saw then that the minute clasper rootlets of the ivy had begun to pry into the almost invisible slits of space between the door and its frame. The entrance hall exuded a peculiar smell, a mixture of decay and growth, damp, sweet, and sickish. Corrington shouted up the stairs, "Millward!" He called again and we waited, but there was no reply. Closing the door behind us, he slipped the key into his pocket. Might as well go up, I guess. As I trudged up the stairs behind him, I noticed that the unpleasant odor became more intense. In the upstairs hall, Corrington looked about in some confusion. Been years since I was in here, forgotten which was his favorite room. At length he settled on the last door to the right, toward the front of the house. He knocked, and there was no reply. Finally, he pounded on the door. "Millward, it's Corrington." Silence. He tried the door and found it locked. Hang it all, I don't have a key for all the rooms. After a moment's hesitation, he shrugged and swung his big shoulder against the door. It crashed inward with a splintering rasp of broken wood and metal. We stepped into the semi-darkened room and stood stricken speechless. In the green, glimmering half-darkness, a thing which had once been human slumped in an armchair a few feet from the front window. It was covered with a great, fluttering, waving mass of huge, five-lobed ivy leaves. Only its outline was visible. For a minute or so, as we remained rooted with horror, the shape itself stayed motionless. Then it moved. It lifted itself from the chair, and a thin, half-stifled scream came out of its mouth. The purplish, fleshy-looking ivy leaves immediately veered in our direction, as if we had been some kind of magnet. The thing fell back in the chair, but the inhuman, high-pitched scream of protest and agony went on and on. The ivy leaves waved frantically. Possibly it was my imagination, but I had the distinct impression that their claspers had descended to the floor in front of the chair and were starting across toward us. At last, Corrington recovered himself. He shoved me toward the door. "Get out at once! Get out of the house!" As I hurried down the stairs, he was right behind me. Even under the circumstances, I felt that this, well, it wasn't like the Corrington I knew or thought I knew. Once outside, I turned to him. "My God, Corrington, what are you going to do?" "You'll see," he replied grimly. I followed him around the side of the house, fighting through an almost impenetrable mass of vegetation. Swearing, he tore his way toward a sort of shed or garage, which was situated in the rear of the house. The building bore such a weight of massed vines, limbs, and leaves, it appeared about to cave in. Somehow Corrington reached it, got one of the doors open, and groped inside. I waited, nearly suffocated in the dense tangle of growth, and presently he pushed his way out. I saw that he was carrying a heavy axe. The blade was rusty, but the handle looked solid. As we struggled back toward the front of the house, I felt certain that the huge tangle had closed in behind us. As soon as we emerged near the entrance door, I understood Corrington's purpose. Pushing his way to the front of the house, he located the main root or trunk of the ivy. I know it may sound absurd, but the infernal thing seemed to sense his plan. The heavy ivy leaves fluttered against his face. I am positive I saw one or more of the claspers fastened on the shoulder of his jacket. But Corrington, once aroused, was formidable. He was not to be stopped. Swinging the axe in a wide arc, he buried the rusty blade in the knotty root. Gasping, he stepped back. I saw that he was staring at the half-severed root. Wiping the perspiration from my eyes, I looked more closely at it. A thin trickle of liquid was seeping out of the ivy trunk. It looked like blood. Corrington swung the axe again and again. Things are handled quietly in Amley, if you know the right people. Corrington knew them. There was no publicity, aside from the stark announcement of Millward Frander's death from circulatory problems associated with a failing heart. The funeral was private and the casket was closed. Corrington, who inherited his cousin's house, had all its surrounding vegetation chopped, cut, and sheared away, down to the last blade of grass. One evening at the club, long afterward, he brought up the subject. "You know," he said, "specimens of that monstrous ivy were sent to some of the best botanists in the country, and they couldn't identify it. Millward must have rooted it out in some remote, unexplored jungle area. It resembles the common ivy, Hedera canarinensis, which is native to North Africa and the Canary Islands, but there are horrible differences. Rootlets of the damned thing had infiltrated a tiny fissure along the window frame where Millward usually sat. We don't know the exact sequence of events. He may have suffered a stroke and been unable to move out of the chair. At any rate, once inside, the ivy headed straight for him. It claspers fastened on him while he was still alive, and hair-like root filaments penetrate into his tissues. It must have been agony beyond our comprehension. Corrington refilled his glass. Actually, however, it may not have lasted long. Even what we saw may have been deceptive. Millward may have already been dead when we entered. But he tried to get out of that chair, I objected. Corrington frowned. Yes, I know that. But, well, you see, it may have been a sort of symbiosis. In other words, Millward may have been clinically dead when we saw him. The ivy root filaments may simply have acted on his nerve endings, galvanized them, so to speak. In other words, he was little more than a sort of zombie, physically animated by outward sources. I shook my head. Hard to believe. That scream. Corrington nodded. I know. But even that might be explained. The autopsy disclosed that the hideous thing had sent its hair-like rootlets right into his brain. The stimulation may have acted on his speech centers, even though he was medically dead. And that red fluid in the root. Corrington grimaced. Thought you'd bring that up. We had it analyzed. It was, part of it anyway, human blood. I had to let it go at that. Corrington, I observed, had closed the subject. Today, whenever I see a friend's house wearing ivy, I immediately urge them to get rid of the growth. I suppose I'm a bit too vehement about it. Some of my acquaintances have begun to consider me a trifle eccentric. The Strange Island of Dr. Nort by Robert Bloch. Between the Greater Antilles and the Lesser Antilles rises a little group of islands generally known as the Medium-Sized Antilles. Mere pimples on the smiling face of the Caribbean, they remain unsqueezed by the hands of man. Far off the usual trade routes, their shores are only infrequently desecrated by a banana-peeling washed-off United Fruit Lines boat. It was here that I came on the fateful day in August, my monoplane circling until it descended upon the broad sandy beach of the central island, the Strange Island of Dr. Nork. How Sidney Dearborn ever heard of Dr. Nork, I cannot say. The old dingbat, doddering around the confines of his palatial estate, seldom pays much attention to his news magazine, let alone interesting himself in the doings of a mere individual. But probably even a man like Dearborn, who is devoting most of his time to becoming an octogenarian, has been for the past 80 years, occasionally pauses and reads the papers. Quite possibly Dearborn read an article about Dr. Nork in one of his own magazines. I can see him calling my editor in New York. Hello, this is Dearborn. Get me an exclusive feature interview on Nork. Nork, Nork. No, I'm not sick. Fella's name, N-O-R-K. Big scientist, lives all alone on an island someplace, doing experiments. How do I know what kind of experiments? Find out for me. Tell our readers. That's what I'm paying you $50,000 a year for, to find out facts. This story on Nork is drivel, pure drivel. No facts. It says he's endowed by a lot of foundations. Endowed for what? Can he split an atom? Get me all the dope. Know what I think? I smell communism. That's what I smell. What would a big scientist want to hide out on an island for if he wasn't afraid? The American people deserve to know. Well, send the man down to see him. Interview him. I want a complete write-up on Nork within 10 days. And say, hello, hello, I want you to be sure and find out where he stands on the oleomargarine tax. That's the way the conversation probably went. I can only guess. All I know is that the managing editor called me into the front office and gave me the assignment. Charter a plane, he said. Get out there, get the yarn, and get back. Get it? I got it, but good. The smooth yellow beach on which my monoplane had landed evidently girdled the island, which was approximately a mile in diameter. Inland palmettos clustered thickly in a dense jungle that ended abruptly at the foot of a gigantic cliff occupying the island's center. Monkeys, macaws, toucans, and parakeets set up a Disney-like clatter as I toted my suitcase and portable typewriter across the sands, but there was no evidence of human life, not even a Burma shave sign. For a moment I wondered if I had made a mistake. I felt like Robinson Crusoe and remembered the stirring episode where he discovers in the sand the imprint of a naked human foot. Then I gasped. I was Robinson Crusoe, for there, before me in the golden sand, was a symbol of life itself. Not the raw imprint of a savage life, but the very essence of civilization. It was an old Pepsi-Cola bottle. I stooped down to pick it up and then noted, with a sudden shock, that the bottle was not empty. A soggy, crumpled sheet of paper had been stuffed down the neck, which was sealed with a battered cap. I pried it loose and fished out the parchment and unfolded the sheet. The message was written in childish scrawl. to whom it may concern. Dr. Nork is a mean, nasty old thing, so there, signed, a true friend. So I was on the right island, after all. My elation as I realized of true friend's warning about my future host. Well, it was no concern of mine. For all I knew, a true friend might be a far meaner and nastier old thing than Dr. Nork. At any rate, I wasn't here to sit in judgment. I was here to get a story on the mysterious medico. Resealing the message in the bottle, I tossed it into the water. Apparently, that had been a true friend's intention, but his aim was bad. I toted my luggage towards the palmetto forest as the macaws formed a screaming rainbow around my head. Oh, those living flames of beauty. Oh, those lovely lambent. Oh, for crying out loud, I muttered. Apparently, it was far safer to walk under the shelter of the trees. I was still wiping my pith helmet when I felt a hand tap my shoulder. I wheeled and recoiled in horror. It hadn't been a hand on my shoulder after all. I beheld a paw. Crouching, confronting me was the shaggy, shambling figure of a gigantic great ape. Gorilla eyes glared, and a tusked maw gaped wide in slavering dread. A growl rumbled up into the threatening throat. "You want handkerchief," said the ape. The intonation was bestial, but the words were human, intelligent. I stared, gulped, and shook my head in amazement. "Who you fella?" the ape demanded. "You fella come safari?" I shook my head again, but the hallucination didn't disappear. "You come in jungle, hunt for diamonds, gold. No? You seek elephant's graveyard. Maybe heap much ivory?" I could only goggle. "You wanna search for white goddess?" I shrugged my heart back out of my mouth and down where it belonged. Then I found my voice again. You can actually talk," I gasped. "I never thought I'd live to hear a gorilla talk like that." The ape grimaced dreadfully. "Sounds pretty corny, huh, Jack?" "I think so, too. All that pidgin English and fake native lingo. Strictly from hunger. But you know how it is with Doc. He makes me talk that way. Says it's what they want to hear. Sometimes I get pretty ashamed when I think that an anthropoid of my education has to go around making like a schmo. But I got my orders. Like I say, you know the Doc." "But I don't know the Doc," I answered. "That's just what I came down here for. I want to meet him." "You from the publishers?" asked the gorilla. "News magazine," I replied. "I'm here for an interview." "Might have known it," the ape muttered. "You don't have a mustache. Thought you were a villain at first, but the villains all have mustaches, don't they?" I was getting confused again. The anthropoid ignored my bewilderment and courteously relieved me of my luggage. "Come on," he growled. "Follow me." He led a path through the palmettos. "Reporter, huh?" he mused. "What do you do evenings?" "How do you mean? Fly, hurdle, sail, batter flame, or blast?" "I don't understand," I confessed. "You must have me mixed up with somebody else. Evenings I go home. Sometimes I look up a friend and play a little gin rummy." "Tell you what you do," the gorilla suggested. "When you get done with the dock, look me up, and I'll take you on for a few hands." The cliff top is a broad, flat plateau overlooking the beach and sea below. The wind blew cold and clear across the treeless expanse, and borne upon its eddies the seagulls wheeled in circle. Remembering the macaws, I made an instinctive grab for my solar toupee and jammed it down over my forehead. Then I peered out under its brim at the domicile of Dr. Nork. Nork's residence sprawled across the plateau like some gigantic concrete wheel. A white-domed central structure acted as the hub from which extended a half-dozen ridae in the shape of wings attached to the main building. The outer circumference was rimmed by a high stone fence, broken by a single gate. The ape led me towards it while I stared up and marveled at the elaborate structure set upon a lonely tropical isle. Then we were standing before the gate, which apparently served as a front door. I noted a neatly lettered sign reading, "Erasmus Nork, M.D. Doctor is in. Please be seated." I had nothing to sit on but my valise. The gorilla opened the front door and bid me enter. He shambled into a spacious white hallway, its antiseptic decor reminiscent of an old Dr. Kildare movie. I followed him in as we walked along the corridor, passing half a dozen closed doors in succession. Finally, we paused before a huge double door at the end of the hall. "I'll announce you," the ape suggested. "Dr. Nork is conducting an experiment." He slipped through the half-open doorway and disappeared. I stood in the hall and listened to the drone of a faraway dynamo. It accented the eeriness of this white palace set in the heart of a tropical jungle. Weird scientific experiments and talking apes? Come right in, my friend, the booming voice resounded from the room behind the door. Welcome to the island. I stepped forward into the laboratory of Dr. Nork. A great arc lighted glared from the domed roof, glared down upon a scene of horror. A huge steel operating table occupied the center of the room and was in use. Strapped securely to its surface was a half-clad girl, hair streaming, mouth contorted, eyes wide with terror. Towering above her was a tall, thin, red-bearded man with a peaked nose and slanted eyes. Like a surgeon, he wore a white gown. Like a surgeon, he brandished a glittering knife. Even as I watched, he raised the crude blade and his arm swooped down to the girl's bosom. The red-bearded man grinned exultantly. "How's tricks?" he whispered. The knife came down. "Stop!" I plunged forward frantically. Hairy arms pinioned me from behind. The ape held me fast. "Hold it," snarled the red-bearded man. "There, got it." "Swell, boss," squeaked an unfamiliar voice from the corner of the room. I twisted my head and saw a little man with a smock standing before an easel. Even as I watched, he did things to the tripod stand, folding it under his arm and gathering the board up, scuttled from the room. The tall man dropped the knife and fumbled with the cords binding the girl. "Curse these knots," he grumbled. "Ought to use the disintegrator." "There you are, Toots." The girl stood up and fluffed out her hair. She smiled at me. No, past me, over my shoulder, where the ape stood. "How's for little Jin?" she said. The gorilla nodded and released me. Linked me, arm in arm, girl and gorilla ambled from the room, and the tall, red-bearded man gestured towards me with his knife. "Sit down, my friend," he said. "You must be tired after your trip. Maybe you prefer to lie down. How about right here on the operating table?" "Oh, thanks," I gulped. "You're Dr. Nork, I presume?" "Of course. Glad to see you. It isn't often we get a chance to converse with a representative of civilization. You must tell me all that's happening in the world. Has an atomic bomb blown up any continents lately?" "I don't know. I left New York yesterday," I answered. Nork shrugged. "So you came all the way down here just for an interview, right? I suppose you want to discuss the new slants we worked out?" "Slants?" I fumbled for his meaning. "I was sent here to find out something about your experiments. I hear you're conducting some mysterious investigations." "Mysterious investigations? Experiments? My dear sir, you've been badly misled. I'm a businessman. This is a business office." Dr. Nork took out a strop and began to sharpen his knife, splitting hairs from his beard to test the keen edge of the blade. "But I heard." "You are mistaken," Nork spoke curtly. At that moment, the door opened and the gorilla entered. "Hey, Doc, those guys are here for the experiments," he announced. Nork blushed and avoided my accusing stare. "Tell them I'm busy," he barked. "Tell them they'll have to wait." "But the subject is already strapped down. The stenographer's ready. Everything is set up." "Confound it," muttered the doctor. "Oh, very well." "You don't have to come down, Doc," the ape said. "Just give me the equipment. I'll take it to them." Dr. Nork shrugged and stepped over to one of the blank, gleaming white laboratory walls. He pressed a tile and something clicked. A section of the wall slid back and revealed a long rack. Objects hung from thongs, dangled from hooks. I stared at the display. There were long black whips, short cat-o'-nine tails, blackjacks, bludgeons, truncheons, clubs, assegais, knotberries, shillags. The gorilla lumbered over and selected an armful at random. "This ought to do the trick, right, Doc?" Nork nodded. Another click and the wall slid back into place. He pressed a second tile. A grating wheeze echoed through the room as a portion of the floor moved to disclose a secret stairway descending into black depths below. The ape clambered down the steps, bearing his homicidal burden. With a loud clang, the floor closed behind him. I reeled bewildered. Whips, weapons, concealed passages, and a nameless experiment. What did it mean? Nork feigned nonchalance as he faced me. "Come on," I said. "Quit stalling. My editor sent me down here for a feature story, and I intend to get it. Now I..." My words were cut short, then drowned out by a ghastly shriek. It came from beneath my very feet, rising in a weird wail and undulation of utter agony. "What's that?" I gasped. "I didn't hear anything," purred Nork. Again, the dreadful scream tore the air to ribbons. "What's going on here?" I panted. "What does it all mean? What kind of experiment needs whips and bludgeons? What are they doing down there?" "Oh, all right, I suppose I'll have to tell you," Nork sighed. "But it's really nothing at all. They're just beating the living hell out of a guy. I made a dive for the doctor's bearded throat. You fiend, I shrieked. Now I know what you are, a mad scientist. Hey, cut it out, yelled Norik. You're tearing my beard. Indeed, the red beard came loose in my hands, revealing a smaller black beard beneath it. Don't touch the black beard. That's genuine, warned the scientist. I just wear the red for sketches. Red seems to be all the thing this season. Wait, let me explain things to you. Explain things? While you're torturing that poor devil down there in the cellar? What poor devil? He's a volunteer. Also a confirmed masochist. He likes to be beaten up. Besides, I'm paying him $500 for his trouble. You're paying him $500? Didn't I tell you this was business? Come on, I'll let you see for yourself. The doctor pressed the wall. The steps below were revealed, and I followed him down into the noisome darkness. As we passed into the night of death, the screams and groans rose hideously. The hair on my scalp followed suit. We groped along a damp stone corridor until we reached a dimly lit room. It was a sight I never expected to see. A sight no man in the 20th century should see. A medieval dungeon. The torchlight flared on rack and strappado, on boot and iron maiden and wheel. Torchlight flickered down on the table where the groaning man writhed beneath the blows of two gigantic men. The ape stood by silently, hand resting on the shoulders of a small man who sat perched on a high stool. Head cocked attentively as though listening, the little man was frantically scribbling down shorthand jottings. Thuds, curses, screeches, blows, moans, and gasps filled the air, but they faded into a sort of background music as the little man beamed ecstatically and babbled at each fresh sound. Whoop! He yelled. Oh! Huh? I murmured. Gutch! Boy, did you hear that one? Gutch! That's a new one, huh, Doc? He peered over his spectacles. Hey! How's for using the brass knuckles now? We ain't had no brass knuckles lately. Okay, grunted the biggest of the men. That is if it's okay with the victim. Oh, okay, don't mind me, piped the man on the table, grinning up through the black and blue blur of his ravaged face. I can take it. Surprisingly, he giggled. Lay on, mad cuff. The men began to seal his midriff with brass knuckles. He howled and grunted at every blow. Splat, yapped the stenographer on the stool. Oh, boys, listen to him. Erk, blip, whizzle. Hey, you with lead pipe. Wrap him on a noggin again. I didn't catch it the first time. There. Spooning. Dr. Knapp tapped me on the shoulder. Had enough, he whispered. I nodded. Let's go. He led the way back to the stairs, calling over his shoulder. Don't overdo it, boys, and be careful how you hit him. Last time you broke three whips and a truncheon. Those things cost money, you know. Boing, yelled the stenographer. Boinga, boinga, boinga. As we plodded up the steps, north side. There's so much to worry about, he confided. So much to do. It isn't easy being the mastermind of all the comic books. We sat in another chamber now. Dr. Norsk's spacious and imposing library. 100 shelves rising to the dizzying heights of the ceiling encircled us on all sides. Every shelf was packed, crammed, jammed full of paper-bound books with lurid covers. Norik reached over to an end table and selected one at random, riffling the pages as he spoke. Of course you can understand what we're doing down there now, he said. Just getting our blurbs, that's all. Feeling the old balloons. Feeling the what? The balloons. You know, the things coming out of the character's mouth in comic books. When a crook gets hit by the hero, he makes a noise. Or the weapon makes a noise. Sometimes they both make noises. Like bang and ouch. There, you see, Dr. Mork beamed. We can't use bang and ouch all the time, or wham and zowie and pow. They're corny. Besides, the flushing chain of comic books covers about 20 titles a month. That means roughly 5,000 separate panels or drawings. Now you figure that at least 4,000 of those panels in every comic book represent somebody getting hit, slashed, flayed, burned, punched, beaten, shot, stabbed, or run over with a steamroller. That takes a lot of different noises and sounds for balloons. We strive for variety, understand? But variety alone is not enough. My boss, the publisher, Blood and Gore Flushing, is a stickler for realism. He wants accurate sounds, so that's why we hold experiments. We beat up a victim and take down the noises for our balloons. Get it? I got it, but couldn't handle it. You mean to say your comic books are drawn from real life? More or less. That's where I come in. Mr. Flushing pays me a fortune, my dear sir, to mastermind the Flushing chain. He endowed this laboratory, set up a fund for research, took me under contract for that purpose alone, to make sure that the 60 million readers of such famous comics as Captain Torture and Hatchet Man get only the finest and most realistic literature. Why would you believe it? When I took over, he only published 3 comic books, and 2 of them were actually funny. It was ridiculous, and I told him, everybody knows that there's no point in a comic book that's funny. Why, people will laugh at it. What they want is thrills, girls with big busts and men with big muscles. I don't know about such comics books, I confessed. I had rather a sketchy education. I thought people just wrote and drew them in some kind of an office. That's the old-fashioned way, Norick laughed. Since I went to work for Flushing, we've changed all that. Ours is a great humanitarian enterprise, catering to 60 million readers as we do, bringing them romance, adventure, murder, arson, insanity, fratricide, bestiality. That's a great responsibility, my boy, and I am keenly aware of it. When I went to work for the chain, I was just a broken-down old Nobel Prize winner, putting around in a laboratory. I smashed a few atoms. That's just about all I did. Now I'm engaged in a great crusade to bring comic book culture to the masses. That's why Flushing hired me. Up to the time I came here, comic books were put out there just the way you said they were, in offices, by artists and writers who worked solely with their imaginations. They kept thinking up new variants of Superman, and that's about all they could do. Occasionally, they did a sort of Tarzan takeoff, or Dick Tracy imitation, but it was stale, flat, repetitious. You see, the trouble was that they lacked facts to go by. They went stale because they didn't know anything about their subject matter. None of them had ever been to the jungle, let alone lived with a gorilla. None of them had ever used a ray gun or split a Japanese spy's head open with a butcher's cleaver. None of them could walk through walls or put on a suit of red underwear and fly through the air. That's where I came in. I brought the scientific method to bear, the experimental approach. Now all the artists and writers work from rough sketches and material supplied by me here in my laboratory. Everything you see in Flushing Comics has been pre-tested and is guaranteed accurate.
You mean you've created a comic book world? I gasped.
More or less. What do you think taught the gorilla to talk? I worked with him ever since he was a tiny rhesus. Made him listen to linguaphone records, everything. And why do you think our drawings are so accurate? Because I have an artist here sketching night and day. You saw me posing as the mad doctor with that girl when you came in. That's why I wore the false red beard. It looks better in color reproductions. Many people have been kind enough to tell me that I make the best and most convincing mad doctor they've ever seen.
I'm sure you do, I said politely.
Take those fellow downstairs. They're working on the sound effects, as I told you. All over this great laboratory, experiments are going on concurrently, and trained observers are noting the results, roughing out sketches, transcribing bits of dialogue, thinking of plots. The result is obvious. Flushing Comics today are beyond all doubt the most realistically gruesome, hideous, ghastly, sanguinary, and horrible comics in the world. But what about all those super characters, I ask? You can teach gorillas to talk and pose for pictures and beat people up, but where do you get the ideas for those invincible heroes with the wonderful powers?
I give them the powers, per Dr. Norick. My experiments in nuclear physics, chemobiology, endocrinology, and mopery have borne fruit. Strange fruit.
As you shall presently see. Speaking of fruit, it's time for luncheon, and now you'll have an opportunity to meet some of the actual characters I've created for Flushing Comics.
Dr. Norick and I dined in palatial splendor. For the first few minutes after our entry into the huge hall, we were alone, save for the silent servants, tall white-faced men who stared straight ahead in impassive obeisance as he offered us our choice of delicacies.
"How trained they are," I whispered, as one of the black liveried footmen served me with a helping of rugged flamingo and pickled eland tongues.
"They never say a word, do they?"
"Not remarkable at all," said Dr. Norick, as he carved the piece de resistance, a huge baked wildebeest head with an enormous apple in its mouth.
"How can they say anything? Some of them are zombies, and the rest of them are dead. I reanimated them myself, you know."
"I didn't know," I gulped. "And I'm not so sure I want to. You actually raise corpses up to be your servants?"
"Sure."
"Don't you read the comics? Scientists are always going into the laboratories and shooting a lot of electrical arcs through bodies. I had to try it myself just for the sake of accuracy. It worked. And after I had these cadavers animated again,
I had no other use for them except as servants. Still, it worries me.
Worries me, too, I agreed. I don't like their looks.
Oh, that doesn't matter, Nork replied. I just don't want the waiters' union to find out.
He gnawed a yak leg and offered me some jellied eel.
Where are the others I was supposed to meet? I asked.
Others?
They'll be along, I'm sure. Matter of fact, here. They come right now.
His remark was unnecessary. My bursting eardrums and bulging eyes attested to the arrival of some exceedingly strange strangers. The first one to enter wasn't so bad. He was obviously human, despite his red cloak and the helmet he wore, which resembled an inverted commode. The only thing that disconcerted me in the least was the fact that he didn't walk in. He flew. Behind him was a hopping figure. It might have been a gigantic frog with a human face. It might have been a gigantic human with a frog's body. Whatever it was, I didn't care for it. Right behind the Bactrian, being stalked a tall man who displayed remarkable stoicism, insofar as his hair seemed to be on fire. Even as I stared, my attention was arrested, tried, and condemned by another gentleman whose exceedingly long neck seemed to be made of wood. This neck was surmounted by a most unconventional head, flat on top, hooked on the rear, and round in the front. There was no features visible in the round surface, which was shiny metallic. My eyes were still finding the battle of the bulge when the girl came in. She was tall, slim, alluring, her body a pale shaft of moonlight, and her hair shimmering simulacrum of the sun. She wore a combination of leopard skin bronze shorts that was very pretty in spots. I saw no reason why she needed to also wear a large boa constrictor for a scarf, but she did. One would also assume that a wench with such long, lithe, lovely limbs might be satisfied to walk. But no. She had to ride on the back of a lion. "Greetings," said the girl as the lion halted before us and began to slapper over my shoes. "Hi," chirped Dr. Nork. He beamed at me. "May my daughter Albino, the white goddess of the jungle."
"Your daughter?"
"Brought up here among the animals to be useful in my work. Decided to make a female Tarzan out of her at an early age, when she showed signs of inheriting my own fondness for wild game. You may not know it, but I used to be quite a sportsman myself. Earned quite a reputation as a deer hunter in my youth. I was a fast man with a buck."
Albino sat down,
unwound her snake and replaced it with a napkin. She began to feed her lion from my plate. "Pass the salt," she said. I did so, trembling. A human salt shaker. She noticed my tremor and sniffed disdainfully. "Where'd you find his jerk paw?" she asked. "You know, I don't like sissies." I was all set to give her a snappy comeback, but something choked off my flow of conversation. That something was the boa constrictor, which now began to twine about my neck. I removed it hastily and wiped my hands on what I thought was a napkin, but napkins don't roar. I took my hands out of the lion's mane and turned to Dr. Nork. "What's an aggregation?" I murmured. "All normal people," he assured me. "At least they were until I got to work on them. You see before you, my dear sir, the results of years of experiments. My daughter was just a plain, ordinary little girl until I taught her how to behave like a monkey. In her case, all that was required was a little child psychology. Instead of giving her dolls to play with, I gave her a talking gorilla. The rest followed easily. In some of the other cases, surgery was necessary. Take Waterboy, for example."
"Who?"
He indicated the frogman. "One of Flushing Comics' most popular characters. I made him, raised him from a tadpole, as it were. As a result of a unique series of experiments, he's now more frog than human. It was a risky business to turn a man into a frog. More than once I thought he'd croak. But you can see for yourself how successful I've been." Nork pointed at the man with the flaming hair. "That's Firebug," he told me. "The human torch. Goes around giving criminals the hot foot. I developed his metabolism to the point where he can actually live on fire."
"That's why he's getting coal, huh?"
"Precisely. And as for our flying man, Rogers?"
"Buck Rogers?"
"No, $2 Rogers, we call him. He's twice as good as Buck." I turned away in bewilderment. "Let me get this straight, once and for all," I said. "You experiment on people and develop superhuman or unusual characteristics. Then you watch their actions and use what you see as the basis for plot material in comic books?"
"Right. Now," a violent pounding interrupted him. The strange being with a long wooden neck and the metallic head was using the blank spot where his face should be, using it as a walnut cracker.
"Hammerhead," explained the doctor. "Our readers get a bang out of him," he giggled. "Did you see our last issue featuring him? Had a sequence where he uses his head as an atom smasher." I tried to ignore the scientist's remarks and made a little time with Albino.
but she obviously despised me for a weakling, just a poor coward who was probably secretly afraid of rhinoceros. Ow! The shout came from down at the end of the table. Hammerhead had accidentally banged the fingers of firebugs. Look what you're doing, clumsy, he yelled. Don't get hot under the collar, retorted Hammerhead. For answer, Firebug opened his mouth, but no remarks came out. Instead, a 6-foot tongue of living flame belched forth. Hammerhead ducked just in time, but $2 Rogers got smoke in his eyes. Rising, cloak whirling about him in red fury, the superhuman flyer whipped out a strange gleaming weapon and leveled it at the human torch. I'll blast you, he yelled. Lightning crackled from the muzzle, and Firebug ducked as an atomic beam disintegrated the chair in which he had been sitting. At the same time, he let go with another burst of flame. Waterboy opened his frog mouth and extinguished the blaze, inelegantly but effectively. What smack? Screamed Rogers, leveling his weapon. Firebug turned toward him, ready to blaze away. Hammerhead poised himself to pound him down. Quiet! Screamed Dr. Nork. Cut it out! Get out of here, all of you! If you can't learn to behave and get along with one another, I'll turn the faceless fiend loose on you. There was a deathly silence. There, said the doctor. That's telling them right. But where are you? Here, I gasped, right here under the table. Albino sniffed. I dropped my fork, I said. You're scared, she accused. I can tell by the way your hand trembles. What hand? The one on my ankle. Take it off. I rose and took my place again. All right, I said. I am scared. Who wouldn't be with all this blasting and firing and pounding going on? If you think these characters are bad, you ought to see the faceless fiend, she told me. Who is he? I noticed everybody shut up when his name was mentioned. Nork's face clouded. He sighed heavily and reached for a platter of breaded horse kidneys. One of my few failures, he murmured. Some of my agents spirited away a mass murderer from the penal colony of French Guiana. That's where I get most of my subjects. You'll find that comic book characters are best when they have criminal minds. Anyhow, this time I intended to create a super criminal for a new book. The man was frightfully disfigured, and as a first step I attempted to remedy his condition with plastic surgery. At the same time, I began psychiatric treatment with deep hypnosis. My aim was to uncondition all his reflexes and inhibit all his inhibitions. This I did while working on his face to remove the scars. Alas, I did my work too well. I had him in a state of complete abandon, psychically, long before his features were rebuilt by plastic surgery. As a matter of fact, I had just finished removing his old features and hadn't gotten around to building new ones when he escaped. Ran away. Of course, when the poor fellow removed the bandages, he found that he had no face left at all. This, coupled with his mental imbalance, resulted in the creation of the perfect supercriminal, the faceless fiend. Nobody knows what he looks like because he doesn't look like anyone. He has no scruples, just hatred of society. Gifted with superhuman cunning, he has managed to evade capture, and even now is lurking somewhere on this island. I've sent my staff out time and again to comb the jungles for him. I've imported several beachcombers just to comb the beaches, but he eludes me. Meanwhile, he swears vengeance on me and all my work. He threatens me in a million ways. I am convinced it is he who writes letters to the press denouncing comic books. Say, wait a minute, I said. I wonder if he wrote that note. I told him about the message I'd found in a bottle on the beach. That's his work, Nork nodded. A dangerous adversary, my friend. The gorilla shuffled into the room and tapped the doctor on the shoulder. Sorry to interrupt, he said, but it's time for you to come down to the crocodile pits. We're getting ready to draw that sequence where Wonder Child ties their tails into Boy Scout knots. If we get that out of the way this afternoon, we can go right on to the scene where he strangles his grandmother, right? Right, Nork rose. Excuse me, he said. The press of business affairs. Perhaps you're tired. I'll ask Albina to see you to your room. Follow me, the girl urged. Do you want to ride my lion? No, thanks. I'll walk. We left the banquet hall and ascended a spiral staircase. The blonde girl led me into a handsomely furnished bedroom. Maybe a little sleep will quiet your nerves, she observed. The scorn in her voice was evident. I'll be all right, thanks, I said. What's that? A rumbling rose, and the air was suddenly suffused with blue flame. Nothing at all, scaredy cat, she snickered. Just a little hurricane coming up, I suppose. Hurricane? I stared out of the window and saw that she spoke the truth. The storm was gathering over the tropical isle. Water boiled like lava across the beach. The palmettos prostrated themselves before the fury of the storm. Wind roared from all points of the compass, and the currents clashed overhead to tear the very air to ribbons. A kaleidoscopic cloud of macaws blew across the island, followed by a white cumulus of seagulls, borne ruthlessly away by the violence of the elements. "Quit shaking, you coward," taunted the girl. "I'll turn on the lights." She did so. I collapsed across the bed, watching the onslaught of the storm. The walls trembled, and I followed suit. "Oh, you're impossible," she told me. "Just like all the other men I've ever met, afraid of everything." "You can't blame me," I replied. "After all, not everybody has your advantages. Being brought up by a gorilla and all that." "Never mind the excuses," Albina said. "It doesn't matter. I've been the white goddess of the jungle here for 5 years, and I'm getting pretty darn sick of it." 2. Always waiting for some strong, handsome, virile He-Man to come along and woo me, like they do in the comic books. And what do I get? A bunch of weaklings, namby-pamby characters who are afraid of everything. Lions, snakes, hurricanes. "And you're not afraid of anything?" "Of course not." "You're sure?" There was a crash overhead, and suddenly the lights went out. The room was black, an inky vacuum in the dark womb of storm. I winced, but the girl's voice rose strong and clear in the darkness. "I fear nothing," she told me, "not even the faceless fiend himself." "That's very good to hear. I'd hate to have caused you any discomfort." "What's that?" I yelled. "Who said that?" "Me, the faceless fiend." "You're here, in this room?" "Just came in through a secret staircase," a slow voice hissed. "I've been waiting to get my hands on you ever since you arrived." "You don't say," I answered, hurling myself in the direction of the door. Thunder boomed and wind howled. "Don't try to escape," chuckled the unseen presence. "You can't see in the dark, but I can, and I'm going to get you." "Help," I yelled. "Albino, save me." "Stay where you are," the girl commanded. "I'm coming." "So am I," cackled the menacing voice. I whirled and cried out. "Ouch," I yelled. Something hit me in the back of my neck. It was the ceiling. When I opened my eyes, I was lying strapped to a table in a long, narrow underground chamber. Blue light flickered in mephitic gloom. Crouching above me was a cloaked figure. I stared up and was rewarded only by a blank look. This creature, this monster, this being with an empty gap between neck and hairline was something not to be countenanced. It was beyond all doubt the faceless fiend. His chuckle sounded out of emptiness, slithering off the slimy walls. "Don't look so unhappy, my friend," he purred. "You ought to thank me for rescuing you. Here you are safe and sound in a nice, comfortable sewer, while above us the entire laboratory has collapsed." "Collapsed? Was it lightning?" "No, just rain. The place just melted away." "How could that be?" "Simple," explained my captor. "Dr. Nork built it all out of guano. Apparently he didn't feed the seagulls enough cement. At any rate, the entire structure has been demolished, and your friends have all perished. No one is left but the two of us." "Dead?" I cried. "All of them? You're sure?" "Beyond a doubt. It's an end to the whole insane scheme. The comic books will go out of existence, and Dr. Nork will no longer be free to perpetrate his wicked experiments in the name of science." "But the girl," I persisted. "Albino, she was in the room with us." "I snatched you through the trapdoor and down the secret staircase just in time. I'm afraid you'll have to face it. We're alone. And now, speaking of facing it," the cloaked figure stooped to the side of the table and rose again. One hand clutched a small saw. "Speaking of facing it," he continued, "I am about to perform a small experiment of my own. Ever since I lost my face, I've waited for a chance to find another. I hid down here in the sewers under the laboratory and bided my time. I didn't want to take a stupid mug like Nork's, and I certainly wouldn't appreciate the visage of any of his monsters. But when you flew into the island this morning, I knew my long vigil was over. Sorry I cannot offer you any anesthetic, but time is short." You mean you're going to steal my face?" I screamed. "I prefer to think of it as a little facelifting job," he answered my captor. "Please now, just relax." The faceless fiend bent forward, saw in hand. It was a typical scene from a comic book story, as such it probably would have delighted 10 million dear little kitties throughout the land, but it didn't amuse me in the least. The saw grazed my neck. A roar shattered the walls. A tawny blur bore the cloaked figure backwards into the shadows. There were screams and growls and other less pleasant noises, generally heard only at presidential conventions or in zoos. "Good work!" Albina was at my side, using the saw and the ropes that bound me. She gestured towards the shadows of the sewer beyond, where the lion was now creating a bodiless fiend. "We got through the trap door in time just behind you. Then part of the walls gave in. We were delayed, but not too long." "Then it's true," I said. The laboratory's destroyed? Everything's gone, she sighed. Even this sewer isn't safe much longer. Let's get out of here. A crash accented her words. Turning, I saw that the shattered portion of the sewer had disappeared, hiding both the lion and the faceless fiend from view forever beneath fresh debris. This way, Albino urged, pulling me along the corridor. There should be a sewer outlet to the beach. Thanks for rescuing me, I panted. Think nothing of it, the girl answered. That's just a reflex action, you know. Been rescuing people for years now for the comics. The damp walls of the sewer twisted and turned. We raced along, Albino taking a lithe-limbed lead. She rounded a curve ahead of me, and I blundered forward. Suddenly she screamed. I turned the corner and grasped her arm. What's the matter? I said. The girl stood there, shaking in a frenzy of fear. Ah, she shrieked. Take it away! Huh? I said. For answer she clung to me and threw herself forward and upward into my arms. I held her close. Look, she sobbed. Down there. Make it go away. Where? I asked. There. But it's only a mouse, I said. She began to cry. I stepped forward, carrying her in my arms, and the mouse retreated to its burrow with a shrill squeak. Albino was weeping hysterically, and the more she cried, the more I grinned. There, there, I said. Don't you worry. I'll protect you. There isn't much more to tell. By the time we emerged upon the broad expanse of the beach, the hurricane had blown away, and only a gentle rain fell upon the ruins of the big laboratory on the cliff. Despite my fears, I found the plane quite undamaged, save for a minor accident that had crumpled part of the landing gear. As it was, I managed to take off and a subsequent landing some hours later in the airport at Jamaica. Within a day, Albino and I were back in civilization. I managed to sell her on the notion, while en route, that a brand of courage was of no value in New York. People seldom encounter lions and tigers in the city, I told her, but the place is simply lousy with mice. What you need is someone like me to protect you. She agreed meekly enough, and that's why we were married, even before I reported to my editor with the story. That episode is still painful in my memory. Being called a liar and a drunkard is bad enough, but when he accused me of opium smoking, there was only one course left open to me. I resign, I shouted as he booted me down the stairs. Still, it's all over now, and Albino doesn't mind. I have a new job. Bought a little newsstand over on 7th Avenue. I don't make much money selling newspapers, but there's always enough to buy a few mousetraps for the house. Besides, I managed to sell quite a lot of comics books.